Under the rules, if Moscow severed communication, then she should not attempt to re-establish it by radio until instructed to do so. After 2 months without a word, Ursula was seriously worried, running low on money and restless. I had lived for this work for years, and now my days were empty. Every month, fearful that someone might spot the pattern of her movements, she cycled to an open stretch of road and felt inside an empty tree root. The centre had broken off contact completely. There must have been a good reason, she told herself. There was indeed a reason, but it was not a good one. The GRU, the mighty military intelligence-gathering machine of the Soviet Union, had got the wrong tree. Instead of leaving messages under the force plane tree after the crossroads, the GRU courier was depositing the cash in the force tree after the underpass, which, by unhappy coincidence, was also hollow at the root. In one of those human mistakes that are as common in espionage as every other profession, the GRU had cocked it up. But the centre was as baffled as Ursula. For reasons unknown, Sonia did not remove the money from the dead drop in the agreed-upon period of time, and we took the money back, a report noted. As far as the centre was concerned, it was Agent Sonia who had broken contact, which could mean only one thing. The British Security Service must be closing in on her. Which it was. Ursula's past was returning to haunt her along three distinct routes and through three different men. Rudi Hamburger, Alexander Foot, and Klaus Fuchs. Her ex-husband, her former collaborator, and her best spy. On the 25th of March 1946, the US legal attaché and FBI representative in London, John Simperman, sent a letter to Roger Hollis of MI5. Please refer to previous correspondence on Rudolf Albert Hamburger, confessed Soviet agent, whose whereabouts has not been established since he left Iran on May the 22nd, 1943. I would appreciate your making arrangements to interview Ursula Hamburger Burton, the former wife of Hamburger, for the purposes of ascertaining Rudolf's present whereabouts. The FBI was actively investigating anyone with communist links. Rudy's brother Victor, now at the University of Chicago, was therefore a suspicious person. The Americans were suddenly interested in the Soviet spy and his ex-wife. Rudi Hamburger's present location was as far removed as it is possible to imagine from the gently undulating Cotswolds. He was in Karaganda labor camp, a huge gulag covering 14,000 square miles of the Kazakhstan steppes. Here, an army of inmates slaved in 50 coal mines, in a landscape so inhospitable that the camp barely needed its machine gun toting guards. Anyone attempting to escape swiftly died in the frozen wilderness. Every morning, it seems inconceivable to me how I got here, Rudy wrote. Hamburger's purgatory had started in Saratova labor camp on the Volga, 500 miles south of Moscow, at the beginning of a 5-year sentence for political crimes. That's what I have become, he wrote, a traitor, a terrorist, a public enemy. Saratova was a timber extraction camp, a penal colony powered by slave labor, and the closest thing the Stalinist state could devise to a half-living hell. The inmates wore identical prison garb of jerkin and quilted black cotton cap, a uniform intended to enforce conformity and insufficient to keep out the biting cold. Their diet consisted of coarse black bread and watery soup. Particles of carrot, fish skeletons, bones and disgusting fish heads that stare at you with dead eyes. After 6 months of captivity, Rudy weighed under 8 stone. When he dared to look in a mirror, he saw a grey, shining skull, the pale, emaciated face of a prematurely aged man. There were no books, newspapers, or radio, and no communication with anyone on the outside. Rudy's fellow convicts included professional criminals running an internal tyranny of fear, violence, and extortion, but also political prisoners like himself, the 58ers, socially dangerous elements convicted under Article 58. Students who had dared to demand freedom of expression, a couple who criticized the war that had taken their only son, a man who picked up and kept a Nazi propaganda leaflet dropped from a German plane. "Keep calm and disciplined," Rudy told himself. "Watch your tongue. You live in the land of unlimited dictatorship. Keep silent." The boredom and hunger gnawed him to the soul. Lying on the bare plank bed, you are like a tortured animal who dully awaits his bitter fate. He tried to forget his former existence and the things he had once loved. It must be possible to renounce the luxury of feelings, not to remember aesthetic beauty which, embodied in art, architecture, music, was part of my life. If you want to survive in the camp, you must not allow yourself to think. A team of American military engineers visited Saratova to supervise the building of a chemicals factory as part of a wartime relief program. A kindly secretary offered Rudy an illustrated American magazine. "Finally, in a language familiar to me, I can read something to distract me from my desperate thoughts." A few weeks later, the magazine was confiscated and he was accused of bringing anti-Soviet propaganda into the camp. A second trial began. The judge has the sharp, cutting tone that I knew from my Prussian fatherland. His task is to inspire fear, to force the accused into the position of a guilty criminal from the outset and stifle any attempt at resistance. Rudy's sentence was extended to 8 more years, and he was thrown into solitary confinement. In the darkness of the cell, there is little difference between day and night. I am vegetating, a breeding ground for lice. I use my wooden spoon to scratch floor plans of buildings into the ice layer on the wall of a house somewhere in dreamland. Mostly I lie in perfect lethargy. News of the fall of Berlin reached the Gulag, and Rudy recorded the moment. "The war is over, the fascists are destroyed," says a guard, laughing, and he throws his arms in the air for joy. A flush of happiness comes over me. The genocide is over. Hitler fascism is defeated. Peace. Suddenly, my own destiny seems small beside this tremendous event. Rudy had lost everything, except his obstinacy. Starving, freezing, lice-infested, worked to the bone, falsely condemned by a callous communist regime, he clung to the ideology he had adopted at Ursula's urging. The decade-long revolutionary shocks and the war have produced a generation of heroic men and women who are building a new society, he wrote. The Gulag cannot block the view of the stars with barbed wire. In 1945, he was transferred to Karaganda to work on the design and construction of new barracks. "Despite life in the desolate steppe, this camp is easier to bear," he wrote. At least he could exercise his architectural skills, though building rows of identical wooden huts was a far cry from the Art Deco edifices he had crafted in Shanghai. He thought often of Ursula and of Michael, the son he feared he would never see again. Here, in a barren land devoid of life, the prospect of 8 years of barbed wire crushes me to the ground. If I have not died by then, where will I go? MI5 was perplexed and somewhat nettled by the FBI's renewed interest in Ursula Burton and her ex-husband, the Soviet spy who had been handed back to Moscow before vanishing. The FBI are being singularly persistent about this case, and I suspect they have some more recent information about Hamburger than we have, wrote John Marriott of MI5. The Americans had already been told a year earlier that Mrs. Burton was above suspicion, since she appears to devote her time to her children and domestic affairs. But now Simperman was back, demanding MI5 interview her and find out where her ex-husband was. "There seems no good reason for supposing the lady can answer his question," wrote Marriott. He told Simperman, "This lady is known to be of communist sympathies, and I should hesitate to interview her on a matter of this sort. Although our investigations into her present husband yielded no evidence to substantiate the suspicions which we entertained about him, nonetheless, these suspicions still prevail, and we are by no means satisfied that he is not a Soviet agent. Interviewing Ursula Burton might tip off her husband, newly demobilized and now working in a plastics factory, that MI5 was suspicious of him. Once again, the exclusive focus on the man obscured the woman and the more important spy. Even so, Marriott dropped a note to Kim Philby at MI6. You will recall that Rudolf Hamburger was a Soviet agent who was detained in Iran in May 1943, first by the Americans and then by the British, and by the latter subsequently handed back to the Soviet authorities. The FBI have now asked us to question Ursula Burton, who, as you will recall, was formerly the wife of Hamburger. For a variety of reasons, I do not feel able to comply with this request. I'm wondering whether you could let me have any information as to the present whereabouts of Rudolf Hamburger. Philby, the KGB's top spy in the UK, was fully apprised of the Ursula Burton case. Whether he also knew she was a fellow spy for the Soviets and deliberately shielded her is unknown. Philby's response was exquisitely civil and entirely obstructive. With regret, he told MI5, MI6 had no knowledge of the present whereabouts of Hamburger. On the 2nd of August 1947, an Englishman walked into the legation in the British sector of Berlin and explained to the startled receptionist that he was a Soviet spy and wished to defect. Alexander Foote had lived at least four different lives, under as many different names, since bidding farewell to Ursula in Switzerland in December 1940. A linchpin of Sandorado's Rotodrei network, for 2 years he passed on a mass of military information to the centre, sometimes coding and decoding for 20 hours a day, and living, as he put it, the life of a monk. The Swiss authorities knew an illegal radio transmitter was being used somewhere in Lausanne. So did the German Abwehr. One or the other was bound to catch him eventually. Foote was taking down a message from Moscow at 1:15 a.m. on the 20th of November 1942 when he heard a splintering crash as an axe smashed through the front door of his apartment. He just had time to demolish his radio and burn his notes using lighter fuel and a brass ashtray kept on hand for that purpose before the room filled with armed Swiss police. I had been expecting some sort of action for weeks and had destroyed all my records, cash accounts, etc. And as a result, there was nothing for the police save a heap of charred ashes and a damaged transmitter. Foote was arrested and taken to Bois Marmé prison. His interrogation was remarkably civilized. It is useless for you to deny your activities, Foote, Inspector Pash of the Swiss Security Service explained as they shared a bottle of scotch in Foote's cell. There is no suggestion that you have acted against Swiss interests, and I am personally inclined in your favor, as you have been working against Germany, the only country in the world which threatens Swiss independence. It is now only necessary for you to make a complete confession, and you will be released immediately. Foote, equally well-mannered, said he would not confess to anything, and that if Pash was correct and he was released, the Soviets would assume he had betrayed them and kill him. I demanded that I remained locked up. Foote enjoyed being in prison. For the first time in years, I was able to relax completely, and I was left in peace to work my way gradually through the prison library. On his release in September 1944, Foote made his way to Paris, contacted the Soviet military mission, and sent a message to the centre. A few weeks later, he was issued with a false Soviet passport under the name Alfred Fedorovich Lapidus and ordered to board the first Soviet plane leaving liberated Paris, bound for Moscow. One of his fellow passengers was Sandor Rado, the rotund mastermind of the Rotodrei, who had escaped capture in Switzerland and made his way to Paris. Another was Gavril Ilyich Myasnikov, a veteran Bolshevik who had taken part in the murder of Grand Duke Michael Alexandrovich of Russia, the first of the Romanovs to be assassinated. After falling foul of Lenin, Myasnikov had gone into exile in France, but was now returning at the invitation of the Soviet embassy. Foote found him a likable old ruffian, and was impressed by his claim to be going to Russia to put Stalin in his place. As the plane took off at 9 a.m. on the 6th of January 1945, Foote was reflective and apprehensive. His commitment to communism had never been more than skin deep. For a long time I had been disillusioned and unhappy about the attitude of the centre. But he still felt a residual duty. Deliberately to desert the work would have been, in my eyes, equivalent to desertion in the face of the enemy. Besides, his spymasters owed him a debt for all his hard work, if they believed him. During a stopover in Cairo, Foote and Rado shared a room at the Luna Park Hotel. The Hungarian cartographer seemed more than usually gloomy. The first night he hardly said a word and declined to come out with me into Cairo for a last fling. During the night, Rado vanished, leaving behind his hat, coat, and luggage. Mute evidence, Foote remarked, of a spy who had lost his nerve. One of the great wartime communist spies did not trust Stalin to reciprocate his loyalty, and with good reason. The plane landed in Moscow on the 14th of January. Myasnikov boasted that Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, would send an official limousine to collect him. Sure enough, a car was waiting. But the grim faces of the escort suggested to Foote that the welcome was not going to be quite as warm as the old Bolshevik was expecting. Myasnikov was arrested on the spot. 8 months later, he was murdered. Foote's reception committee was much more attractive. Major Vera Polyakova of the Red Army, the English-speaking officer who had run the Swiss networks from Moscow throughout the war. With her dark hair and slim figure, Polyakova was quite a beauty, Foote reflected. He was taken to a modern block of flats, shown into a two-room apartment, and introduced to a burly man named Ivan. Interpreter, escort, guard, all in one. The questioning started next morning, and it was not friendly. It was obvious from the tone of the questions that the centre regarded me as an agent provocateur planted on them by the British. For days, and then weeks, Polyakova peppered him with questions, sometimes in person, sometimes written, detailed and overlapping, a mesh of confusing and contradictory interrogation designed to trip him up. Sandor Rado, she told him, was a criminal who had embezzled funds in Switzerland. The GRU would bring him back. Sure enough, after being refused political asylum by the British Embassy in Cairo, Rado tried and failed to commit suicide. In August 1945, he was extradited to Russia and sentenced to 10 years in prison for espionage. It will not be long before Russia can collect people from anywhere in the world if they are wanted, Polyakova told Foote, a warning of the fate I might expect if I deserted. So far from flirting with him, Polyakova was offering to drag Foote back and kill him if he tried to defect. Foote was given a new alias as Alexander Alexandrovich Dimov and told he could explore the city so long as Ivan accompanied him. On one of those excursions, they were stopped by a militiaman and told to produce papers. Ivan told the man to contact his superior. Moments later, a KGB officer, 5 feet tall and sporting a livid black eye, arrived and began shouting. Polyakova had told them not to answer questions, so when the little man angrily demanded that he identify himself, Foote looked down on the ranting blob of officialdom and told him, slowly and precisely, to fuck off. The little KGB man scribbled in his notebook. The contretemps was sorted out by means of a single phone call, and Foote and his minder returned to the flat, but the incident left a permanent misunderstanding. Whenever Foote went out for a walk, the militiamen cordially greeted him as Comrade Fuckoff. After 6 weeks of daily interrogations, Major Polyakova appeared once more, now accompanied by a senior officer who spoke perfect English and sported an incongruously gaudy tie. In his early 40s, he was intelligent and intellectual and a first-class interrogator. This was none other than the director of the GRU himself, come to grill Foote in person. The interrogation lasted until the small hours and started again the next day. "I felt I was on trial for my life," wrote Foote. Finally, the general rose and slapped Foote on the back. He stated there was nothing with which I could be reproached, and I was entirely exonerated, and he thanked me for my efforts in Switzerland. When, Foote asked, could he go back to work for the greater glory of the Soviet Union? The director was cagey. "It would be necessary to let things calm down for a period before I could be used abroad again." The ordeal had been shattering, but Foote felt the danger had lifted. We parted, with him convinced, I think, of my flaming enthusiasm for the cause in general and Soviet espionage in particular. That was the impression I wished to convey. That impression was false. What little zeal Foote had once had for communism was evaporating amid the harsh realities of life in Soviet Russia. I was determined to get out and return to a world where freedom was more than a propaganda phrase. The only way that I could get out alive was to feign enthusiasm for any espionage plan put up and then get out of the clutches of the center as fast as possible. It would be another year before the opportunity arose. In the spring of 1947, the GRU ordered Foote to travel to Berlin posing as Albert Müller, a German soldier with an English mother, hence his accent, who had been captured by the Russians near Stalingrad and now sought repatriation to Germany. Once he had obtained German identity papers, he was to travel to Argentina. There, posing as an unreconstructed fascist, he should infiltrate the circle of high-ranking escaped Nazis and then use South America as a springboard to establish a new spy network inside the USA. The center's network in the States was in a bad way after the exposure of several agents, Major Polyakova explained, and the Red Army was determined to build it up again from the bottom. Foote would be the architect. In late February, traveling under the alias Granatov, Foote flew to Berlin. "Unless I bungled things at the last moment," he wrote, "there seemed every chance that shortly I would be able to cut myself loose from the center forever." On a sunny summer afternoon in 1947, Albert Müller showed his papers to the guards at the crossing between the Soviet and British zones of Berlin and walked straight into the arms of British intelligence. 2 days later, with an MI6 escort, he was back in London. Alexander Foote told MI6 almost everything. He described how, as a young fighter returning from Spain, he had been recruited in London and sent to Switzerland. He explained how Ursula Kaczynski, Agent Sonia, had trained him and Len Burton in wireless operations and bomb-making. He revealed their aborted plots to kill Hitler and blow up the Zeppelin, and described how Ursula's nanny had almost destroyed the network. He detailed the workings of Sander Rado's network, his own arrest and release by the Swiss authorities, and the events that had led him from Lausanne to Paris to Moscow to Berlin, and finally to London. Holed up in a safe house at 19 Rugby Mansions W14, the spy offered up chapter and verse, furnishing MI6 with its first detailed description of wartime Soviet intelligence in Switzerland. Foote displayed a complete lack of nerves and boundless self-confidence. "He considers himself to be a first-class operative," MI6 noted. When asked why he had switched sides, Foote explained that he was disillusioned by the lack of freedom in Russia and had turned against his former masters because he felt they were going to make war. The interrogator was dubious. "I doubt whether Foote has any real political principles whatever." Foote hinted that he would like a job in British intelligence, perhaps as a double agent. "The Russians have every confidence in me. They know I can do almost anything, and so I can." MI6 was impressed. Foote has not lost his nerve and is certainly not on the run. But he was too unpredictable to use as a double agent. There is a possibility that a man of Foote's character and position might turn to crime. It might be best to leave him to his own devices. Alexander Foote had told MI6 the truth, but not all of it. Ursula Kaczynski, he insisted, had retired from the spy business long ago. He described how upset Ursula had been by the Nazi-Soviet pact and Stalin's invasion of Finland, which was true, and claimed that as a result she had severed all links with Moscow, which was false. Her departure for England, he said, had brought her espionage career to an end. He spoke vaguely of some continuing connections with Russia, but insisted that from 1941 onwards she had been inactive. She was thankful to sink back into respectable obscurity, Foote claimed. Moscow was equally thankful to let her go. I do not think since that time she has had any connection with a Russian spy net. Foote knew this was a flat-out lie. He was willing to tell MI6 all about Soviet espionage, but he was not prepared to betray his old friend. And his efforts to protect her did not end there. The German communist Fred Ullmann had played a role in Foote's recruitment back in 1938, when he put Ursula in touch with his former comrades-in-arms from the Spanish Civil War. 9 years later, he answered the door of his Hampstead home. In front of him stood an agitated individual he did not immediately recognize and took for a beggar or a sick man. It was his old comrade, Footy. He refused to come in, trembled and stammered incoherently. Len and Sonia, great danger, not to work, destroy everything. Then he ran away. Ullmann passed an urgent message to Ursula describing this strange visit. Foote's frantic words meant little to Ullmann, but to Ursula they spelled calamity. Her former collaborator must have gone over to the other side. Doubtless he had spilled the beans about their work in Switzerland, but out of residual loyalty and a British sense of fair play, he had risked a secret warning before the security officials could visit our house. He had not betrayed her. Ursula's agents never did. But he had brought the British spy hunters almost to her door. Inside the GRU, Foote's disappearance sparked consternation and recrimination. Major Polyakova was sacked instantly and then disappeared. All Foote's intelligence contacts, most importantly Ursula, were now compromised. The centre had already severed contact with her accidentally. Now the disconnection was intentional. Sonia was on her own. Ursula waited for MI5 to turn up. She did not have to wait long. Millicent Baggett's long-held suspicions were confirmed. Ursula Burton was, or had been, a Soviet spy. She went back over the letters Ursula had sent to her family from Switzerland. One, written to her sister-in-law Marguerite in 1940, looked, on closer examination, distinctly dubious. Except knitting, which is not my strong side, one is not allowed to do much here, Ursula had written. But reading an appeal for getting ready for blood transmission, I replied. They examined me and found that I have very useful blood, and it can serve all different blood groups. Baggett suspected the letter contained a secret message. Blood transmission was code for radio transmissions, and the reference to different groups was interpreted as a hidden clue that Ursula was training others as radio operators. MI5 concluded, cryptic passages appear to refer to secret political activities. A subject of hitherto tepid interest to Baggett's bosses was suddenly white hot. The case was taken out of Millicent's hands, and Sir Percy Sillitoe, the new Director General of MI5 and a former police chief, took over. Letters to and from the Furs were intercepted and closely scrutinised. The telephones of Ursula's siblings were tapped. Ursula's bank statements were combed for evidence of suspicious money movements. Len was now working as a machine fitter at the Northern Aluminium Company in Banbury, where MI5 had an informant, a former policeman named Richard Curley. When Len was at his workstation, Curly opened Len's briefcase in the staff cloakroom and reported that it contained various kinds of books and leaflets of communist propaganda. Discreet local inquiries revealed nothing out of the ordinary in her behaviour, and some in MI5 wondered how Ursula could possibly have time to spy, since her hands are fairly full with domestic duties. It was impossible to put the Furs under direct surveillance, since any stranger turning up in a remote village like Great Rollright would have been spotted at once. The local policeman was told to keep a special watch on the Burtons, and the chief constable of the Oxfordshire County Constabulary, Lieutenant Colonel Herman Rutherford, was secretly briefed on the case. "We hope, through the medium of your observation and our investigation, to find out some more about their activities so that we can determine whether or not they are engaged in espionage at the present time." Colonel Rutherford expressed great interest in the case. This was an understatement. Rutherford was wildly overexcited. The prospect of digging a communist spy out of Great Rollright was simply thrilling, and the chief constable wanted to arrest her in person. There was no time to waste. Ursula, if not already regarded by the Russians as blown, will undoubtedly be so when Foote's defection to the British is known, MI5 warned. The possibility cannot be excluded that she came here with a mission. She should be questioned at once, preferably before the Russians have had time to inform her of Foote's fate. The best person for the job was Millicent Baggett. Instead, the case was handed over to William Jim Scarden, former police inspector, head of the surveillance squad known as the Watchers, and the country's foremost exponent of cross-examination. Scarden read Ursula's file with relish. Soon MI5's Grand Inquisitor would be bending his steps to Great Rollright to break her. Chapter 23, A Very Tough Nut. In the summer of 1947, Ursula's parents came to stay at the Furs. She did not tell them of her fears. Berta was pale and weak. One night at 2 a.m., Ursula heard groans coming from their bedroom. Mother was having a heart attack. Through the thin walls, Ursula heard her cry out, "Oh, my little boy!" She was thinking of Jürgen, her eldest, whom she had loved most of all her children. Great Rollright's only public telephone, on the village green, was out of order. Ursula pedalled fast through the darkness to Chipping Norton and woke the doctor, who drove her back in his car. It was too late. Ursula's relationship with her mother had always been confrontational, but her death was a profound blow. Berta was buried in the churchyard at Great Rollright. After 45 years of marriage, in good times and bad, Robert Kaczynski was devastated. Ursula persuaded him to remain at the Furs. A few weeks later, a letter arrived from Victor Hamburger. "I have a bit of good news. Rudy is alive." Victor had received a postcard from one Maria Jablonska, a Polish woman from Danzig, recently released from the Gulag. "I have returned home from Russia, and I am happy to be able to tell you that your brother Rudolf is alive. He is very homesick after his family, and mostly after Misha. Please write by return of postcard, and I will give you more details." Victor's letter continued, "You can imagine how happy we all are. Of course, we must give up almost all hope of seeing him again in the next few years." Ursula debated whether to tell Michael that his father was a prisoner in Russia. "She told me in a very roundabout way, but said he was in exile," Michael remembered. She did not say where. MI5 read the letter with interest and passed word to John Simperman of the FBI that Hamburger was alive and incarcerated in a Russian labour camp. Colonel Joe Spencer, the British security officer who had interrogated Rudy in Tehran before handing him over to the Soviets, was also informed. "It appears the kind Russian reception which he told you he expected was not forthcoming, and he still has 5 years to serve in his concentration camp." Ursula was comforted by the news, but it brought fresh uncertainties. What cruelties had poor Rudy suffered? How much longer would he remain a prisoner of the Soviet Union? Would he ever see their son again? As summer waned, Ursula mourned her mother, feared for Rudy, yearned for some supportive signal from the centre, pondered Foote's secret message, and waited for the knock on the door that would herald the arrival of MI5's bloodhounds. It came at exactly 1:20 on the afternoon of Saturday, the 13th of September, 1947. Ursula opened the door to find a policeman on the doorstep flanked by two men in civilian clothes. The policeman removed his helmet and announced himself as Detective Constable Herbert of Chipping Norton Police Station. His companions were introduced as Mr. Saville, Michael Serple of MI5, and Mr. Snedden, in reality Jim Scarden, MI5's fabled interrogator. These gentlemen would like to talk to you, Mrs. Burton. May we come in? Robert Kaczynski was reading a magazine in the sitting room. He rose and gracefully bowed himself out. After showing Ursula his police badge, Detective Herbert also departed. The two men perched awkwardly on the settee. Ursula took in her uninvited guests. Serple, an expert in communist subversion, was acutely embarrassed to be interrogating a housewife in her apron. Scarden, however, might have been dressed for the part of spy catcher in chief. He wore a grey Macintosh and trilby, along with a thin, unpersuasive moustache and a faintly sardonic expression, disguised for the fact that he had very little idea what he was doing. A dapper, pipe-smoking former policeman, Scarden had a high opinion of his own abilities, according to one colleague, which he strongly encouraged others to share. He did not like women and refused to allow female officers to take part in surveillance operations, since this might expose their male colleagues to extramarital temptations. He was ponderous, punctilious, polite, and as chief watcher, startlingly unobservant. He epitomised in his manner the world of sensible middle-class values, tea in the afternoons and lace curtains, a cast of mind that was to prove highly ineffective against hard-boiled Soviet spies. He would interview Kim Philby 10 times and declared himself more convinced of his innocence at the end than he had been at the start. He interviewed Anthony Blunt on 11 occasions over a 13-year period and cleared him every time, fooled by Blunt's upper-class bluster. He also exonerated John Cairncross, another of the Cambridge Five, and Edith Tudor Hart, who had first recommended Philby to the KGB. For a celebrated spy catcher, he was remarkably bad at catching spies. Scarden's first mistake was to underestimate his quarry. Mrs. Burton is a somewhat unimpressive type, with frowsy, unkempt hair, perceptibly greying, and of rather untidy appearance. His second error was to reveal his hand. "You were a Russian agent for a long time until the Finnish war disillusioned you," Scarden declared. Without pausing for breath, he went on, "We know that you haven't been active in England and we haven't come to arrest you." At a stroke, Scarden had exposed the weakness of MI5's position. Ursula's espionage in Switzerland had been aimed at Germany. She could only be held to account if she had spied in Britain, against Britain or her allies, and Scarden had just revealed he had not a scrap of evidence she had done so. This psychological attempt to take me by surprise was so funny and inept, and so far from throwing me off balance, that I almost burst out laughing. "Would you like a cup of tea?" she asked. "Shall I fetch my husband?" Ursula called Len in from the garden and put the kettle on, knowing she already had the upper hand. If she simply stonewalled, then Mr. Snedden would have nothing to go on, and nothing was exactly what she intended to give him. Len entered the sitting room. "Burton looks uncommonly young, even for his 33 years," Scarden wrote, "but he was completely overshadowed by his wife, who quite dominates the household." Once tea was served, Scarden resumed. "I went straight into the attack and told Mrs. Burton we had a vast amount of information in our possession and we required her cooperation to to help clear up ambiguities. The evidence, he hinted darkly, came from a leakage from the Russian intelligence service. Ursula smiled sweetly. I do not think I can cooperate. I do not intend to tell lies, and therefore prefer not to answer questions. Skardon had never come across a woman like this before. He liked them tidy and meek. It is fair to say right away, by the stand that she took, she tacitly admitted that she had worked for the Soviet intelligence in the past. The manner in which she did so was a credit to her earlier training, for every possible piece of cajolery, artifice, and guile that could be was employed, without any success whatsoever. Skardon pressed on. We know you became disillusioned with communism after the invasion of Finland by the Soviet Union. We know you are a loyal British subject and would not engage in any blameworthy enterprise here. You have nothing to fear. We know you have not been guilty of anything in this country. Since you have recognized the real worth of communism, why not cooperate and tell us about your time in Switzerland? Again, Ursula dead batted. I confirmed my loyalty, but said that did not oblige me to talk about my life before I became a British citizen. I replied that while I had experienced disappointments, I could not describe myself as anti-communist. Besides, I was of the opinion that there was no contradiction between being a loyal British citizen and holding left-wing views. Skardon was frustrated. It is impossible to demonstrate that you are a champion interrogator if someone refuses to answer your questions. She made no denial whatever, repeatedly sheltering behind the rock of non-cooperation. Skardon turned his attention, somewhat sourly, to Len. We know about your close acquaintance with Alan Foote. Footy, said Len, as if half recalling a name from the distant past. Oh, yes. What is he doing these days? Skardon's thinly genial manner was evaporating fast. Ursula offered more tea and asked if she might be excused for a few minutes as she was baking a cake for a children's party to celebrate Peter's 4th birthday. Left alone with what they perceived to be the weaker vessel, Skardon and Serple went to work on Len. We broke into Burton's taciturnity, but in spite of every inducement, we did no more than elicit from him that he met Mrs. Burton in Brighton in 1936. Len claimed he had bumped into her again, quite by chance, in Switzerland, as one meets people in the Prisonnier. Skardon was now properly peeved. After a longish interval, Mrs. Burton returned, still in an uncooperative frame of mind. We used every conceivable argument with her, but she said that even to explain why she was not cooperative would be to deal with the past, and she preferred to say nothing rather than to mislead. Skardon told Ursula that her loyalty to her former employers would not be reciprocated. She replied that her loyalties were to ideals rather than people. He warned that some of her family might come under suspicion if she did not come clean. She preserved a Slav-like indifference. After nearly 3 hours of fruitless jousting over the teacups, Skardon rose and stiffly announced that they would return the next day in the hope that upon consideration she would change her attitude. She did not. Once more, all the advantages of cooperation and, by inference, the dangers of reticence were detailed to her, but she remained adamant. Only once did her guard slip. Foote had candidly admitted committing perjury in the Swiss courts by falsely testifying that Rudi Hamburger had committed adultery with Brigitte in a London hotel in order to secure Ursula's divorce. Skardon wrote, Mr. Serple very skillfully worried Mrs. Burton by using the word divorce repeatedly. Ursula and Len exchanged surreptitious glances. There is no doubt that this dissolution of her marriage is a weak chink in her armour, but the papers appear to be in order, and there seems little justification for an all-out attempt to invalidate the Burton-Hamburger marriage and throw her back to German nationality. The second day of interrogation ended like the first, in stalemate. As they left, Serple attempted some small talk admiring Ursula's roses blooming over the front door. "It is beautiful here. I shouldn't mind living like this." Ursula grinned. "That could be arranged. I am letting rooms." Skardon wrote up an irritable report of the interrogation. We got little positive information. There is reason to believe that Mrs. Burton gave up her agency for the Russians on ideological grounds when they behaved so badly, from an anti-fascist point of view, at the beginning of the war. She is quite clearly fanatically anti-fascist and agreed to some extent that she was disappointed with the Russian policy of 1939-40, commenting that many people lose faith in governments but retain their political beliefs. There is one gleam of light in this rather abject failure to make Mrs. Burton talk. She agreed that if for any reason she changed her mind, she would communicate with us through Detective Herbert at Chipping Norton. There is just a chance, though remote, that she may take this opportunity. The good the interview can have done may be to strengthen the desire of the Burtons to have nothing more to do with intelligence work. We are reasonably satisfied that they are not at present engaged in espionage, and there is no reason to suppose that they have been for some time. Sir Percy Sillitoe wrote to Colonel Rutherford of the Oxfordshire Police, dashing his hopes of a dramatic arrest. The interrogation was disappointing, no fresh light being thrown on the lives of these people. There is no reason to suspect them of present or even recent espionage activities, although both are communists. MI5 believed the fiction that Ursula had given up spying back in 1940. To catch her, Skardon would need hard evidence that she had spied in Britain, and he did not have any. Ursula was more rattled by the encounter with MI5 than she showed. Robert Kaczynski was also deeply worried and suffering from the cancer that would kill him within a few months. He rushed back to London to tell Brigitte what had happened. News that Ursula had been interrogated flew round the family. Jürgen had already moved back to Berlin, and he now wrote urging Ursula to come and join him in building the new communist state of East Germany. "Try as soon as possible to come and visit us. You must see the situation for yourself and then decide about everything and make your plans accordingly." Ursula was tempted by Jürgen's suggestion. The unpleasant Mr. Snedden had been seen off, but for how long? Len was miserable, bored by his job at the aluminium factory and hardly sleeping. The artillery fire he had been exposed to in Spain had left him with raging headaches. His depressions became more frequent. He withdrew into silence for days on end. Though she continued to check the dead drop site, there seemed no hope of the GRU re-establishing contact. My life had run aground. But at precisely the moment when she began to imagine a new existence, Ursula's past reappeared in the distinctive shape of the woman who had first brought her into the world of espionage. By chance, she discovered that Agnes Smedley was in Britain, living just a few miles away in Oxford. Smedley's restless and angry campaign on behalf of international communism was coming to an end. In 1941, she had returned to the US and taken up residence in the Yaddo Writers' Colony in upstate New York to write a biography of the Chinese Red Army general, Zhu Dai, while continuing to work, in the words of the Chicago Tribune, as the principal apologist for communist China. The FBI was watching. She was forced out of Yaddo in 1948. A few months later, a US Army intelligence report identified her as a key figure in Richard Sorge's spy ring, unleashing a slew of front-page headlines around the country. Army says Soviet spies got Tokyo war secrets, accuses woman writer. She threatened to sue, a dangerous tactic given that she was guilty. The McCarthyite communist hunters were in full cry. She embraced her own martyrdom. The reptile press burned another witch at the stake. Agnes's health had been undermined by her years in the Chinese war zones, and while her heart was ready for another fight, her mind and body were not. She booked a one-way passage to England and took refuge in the Oxford home of her friend Margaret Sloss. Ursula longed to see Agnes again. but feared doing so might lead MI5 to her old friend. An irresponsible visit from me might have jeopardized her politically. In any case, I did not know how she might have changed over the years. How should I approach her? They might both be under MI5 surveillance. If she was spotted making contact with an accused Soviet spy, that would only reinforce their suspicions. Should she take the risk of linking up with Agnes, with all that this might entail, or avoid contact with her oldest friend, her first mentor? Once again, her heart pulled Ursula one way, and her spycraft another. Back in China, at the moment their relationship ruptured, Smedley had accused Ursula of putting personal issues ahead of her commitment to the cause. Her decision now proved that the reverse was true. She decided she must not and would not try to re-establish contact with the woman who had recruited her. Agnes Smedley had ceased spying years earlier, but Ursula had not. That gulf was unbridgeable. Other voices floated back from her past, impossibly distant now. From Shanghai, Johann Patra sent beseeching letters in fractured English, urging Ursula to write to the German emigrant relief organization in China, supporting his claim to be a refugee from Nazism who should be repatriated to Germany. The GRU had severed contact with him too, and the rule against contact between spies no longer applied. He was working as a mechanic, earning barely enough to avoid starvation. Foreigners are leaving China for various countries, North and South America, Australia, Russia, Europe, etc. The United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration would finance my trip to another country if I wished to go. What do you think of this? After all, your advice is important. If I were to go to another country, to South or Central America, say, I might possibly earn more money, and I should be able to help you. I have also learned to think in practical terms. You are really more tied to Europe than I am. Patra explained that he had married a German woman named Luisa, and they had adopted a child. Can you think of it that I have a wife and child? You could never understand that. You thought that I am more of stone. I like him just as if he would be mine. I gave him the name Peter. The economic and political situation here is very bad, and the time for drastic changes will have to come. I should very much like to see you. I am so proud of you. You are happy in important matters. She wrote to the emigrant organization as Patra requested, but heard nothing back. Robert Kaczynski died on the 25th of November 1947 and was buried alongside Berta in Great Rollright. The obituaries lauded a pioneering statistician. There was no mention anywhere of his secret work through his daughter for the USSR. Ursula was plunged into deep mourning. We had known what to expect for some time, but all the same, his death has been a great shock, she wrote to Jürgen. Father was marvellous, right to the end. Ursula had adored and revered her father, proved herself a political force in his eyes, and recruited him into the secret world. His death severed yet another link with Britain. The appeal of a new life back in her homeland was growing. She was still only 40 years old, young enough to start again. Jürgen, now living in the Soviet sector of Berlin, was pressing. Come and visit us. Once and for all, give up the empty life you are living, and you will easily have your choice of political work over here. Jürgen knew his letters would be read by MI5. Political work was a euphemism for spying. She replied, apart from making a home for my husband and children, my life seems fairly useless. Writing? How much I would love to do that. I must make Len's evening meal. He's just coming off the late shift. East Germany, occupied and administered by Soviet forces, was being fashioned into the German Democratic Republic, surrounding but not including West Berlin. A state run by German communists and a slavish satellite of Moscow, the GDR would become a place of strict ideological conformity enforced by an all-seeing secret police force, the Stasi. But in 1948, it represented a beacon of hope for German communists. In the eyes of people like Jürgen, the socialist workers and peasants state would be a Marxist-Leninist paradise, and he intended to be part of it. He urged Ursula to come too. There would be plenty of opportunities in the new Germany for faithful communist spies. Still, she hesitated. Len spoke poor German. The children were now completely English. They loved Great Rollright. That summer, she and Len took the children to Butlin's holiday camp on the south coast. Nina described this quintessentially British post-war holiday as the loveliest experience she had known in her short life. During the whole day, there were loudspeaker announcements. Every evening, there were dances, there were roundabouts and swings. The high point was the beauty contest. Lovely legs and a pretty face, that was all you needed. After this visit, I had a new dream. I wanted to marry Mr. Butlin, become rich, and be able to take my holiday every year in such a camp. Peter made his older sister cry by telling her, "You'll be lucky to marry a rag and bone man." Nina was an ardent royalist, collecting every newspaper cutting about the royal family and pasting them into a large scrapbook. She particularly admired Princess Elizabeth. "When I was told to fetch a large cabbage from the garden, I screamed, 'The princess doesn't have to do such work in the garden.'" Little Peter collected dinky toys, the miniature vehicles made from zinc alloy. Michael had won a scholarship to read philosophy at Aberdeen University. Could Ursula really remove her British children from the place they saw as home? How would they all adapt to life under communism? She had not been lying to Skardon when she spoke of her disappointments with communism. Tearing herself away from Britain to a land she had last seen 20 years before seemed like madness. Great Rollright soothed her. "If I felt low, I would just wander to a favourite spot nearby, where I had a view across the fields and hills." In 1948, she applied for a temporary visa to enter Berlin, but was told visas were still available only to visitors on official business. Jürgen came up with an alternative plan. He would be travelling to Czechoslovakia early the next year on academic business and suggested they meet there instead. The orphaned Ursula felt an urgent need to see her older brother, lay out her troubles and get some good advice. She flew to Prague on the 18th of January 1949. MI5 alerted the MI6 station chief in the city that she was on her way. Ursula Burton was an active espionage character in Switzerland during the war. "Let me know if she comes to your notice in Czechoslovakia." The reunion was a disappointment. Jürgen was busy with self-important meetings and could spare her just an hour of his time. He was all business. Jürgen never had any time for soul-bearing or displays of emotion. Ursula should return to Berlin, he insisted, but obtain Moscow's approval first. "It would be very difficult for you to stay in Germany without the Center's agreement." Jürgen never broke the habit of telling his sisters what to do. Against espionage rules, she wrote a letter to the director of the GRU, noting that she had not heard from the center for 2 years, describing the dead drop site beyond the first crossroads after the railway crossing near Great Rollright, and requesting permission to come to Germany. She signed the letter Sonja, sealed it inside an envelope addressed to the military attaché, and then, having ensured she was not being followed, delivered it by hand to the Soviet embassy in Prague. Then she returned to England and waited. The Cold War battle lines were redrawn with grim clarity on the 29th of August 1949, when the Soviet Union conducted its first secret nuclear weapons test in Kazakhstan. US weather reconnaissance aircraft picked up the radioactive debris, and on the 23rd of September, President Truman announced, "We have evidence that within recent weeks, an atomic explosion occurred in the USSR. Soviet atomic scientists had achieved remarkable results thanks to their spies inside the Manhattan Project, chief among them, Klaus Fuchs. Ursula read of the bomb test and felt a surge of pride. The Soviet bomb was virtually a copy of the American one. In the US, the successful test was codenamed Joe 1 in jocular reference to Stalin. But the intelligence community was shocked by the swift progress of the Soviet atomic weapons program. The CIA had estimated the Russians would not develop the bomb before 1953 at the earliest. MI6's estimate was even longer. Overnight, America's assumed nuclear monopoly had evaporated.